From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Worldwide indeed. Matter of fact, I got an email today from an American who was in China doing some work, listening to us. And listens wherever he goes, all around the country. He just gets his computer and on he goes. Peter Lantz, our guest. Peter, let's go back now, talk about this lie detector test. It's important, I think, as we build the credibility of Scarpa and also find out why they want to discredit him.
Okay, well, I'll go as close to a verbatim as I can with respect to what Angela told me. And this is coming from Greg directly to Angela Clemente, a forensic investigator. She said that he was visited by a polygraph administrator from Washington office, which is curious that they didn't send somebody from Denver, and that the guy inflated the cuff, which is part of the procedure, and began asking questions about 1996 and Ramzi Youssef. And Greg was like, what are you asking me this stuff for? Don't you want to know about, Terry Nichols? And the guy got up and walked out of the room and came back and began asking him a question relating to whether or not he had been given some kind of benefit by one of the guards in the prison. And he's like, he couldn't understand where he was going with that. Then, according to Greg, the guy said, don't answer verbally, just nod your head for yes and shake your head for no, which...
on a lie detector test.
Any polygraph examiner will tell you is absolutely not part of the protocol. And then when Greg, like, I don't know how long that went on, the guy reportedly got up, leaned 2 inches away from his face and said, the book is now closed on Greg Scarpa Jr. You're a fabricator. You're a liar. Don't ever call us again. And Greg said, wait a minute, you're not going to take any of these notes I have from Terry Nichols? You're not going to test them for fingerprints to see if I'm credible? He's offering him notes from Terry Nichols. The guy walks out without them. Now, again, I was not in the jail.
Right.
I didn't see it.
I understand.
But this Agent Stern was there, and he was summoned to Washington a few days after recently, apparently. So, look, let's understand who is who here. Valerie Caproni, Caproni, is the general counsel now to the FBI. She's the head lawyer for the FBI under Director Robert Mueller. Valerie Caproni was the former, as I said, head of the criminal division in the Eastern District that presided over this cover-up of the TWA 800 case that, was the one that had the most to lose if Scarpa Jr. had been made credible and that they believed him with respect to his father. She had the most to lose. All the cases in the Eastern District were under her command. Furthermore, let's talk about who else Valerie Caproni is. There's a courageous journalist named Jim Sanders, who you may know.
Oh, yeah, I know him well.
Jim Sanders, as you know, was an advocate along with Jack Cashel, another journalist I respect, with the missile theory. Now, I don't happen to agree with the missile theory, but I respect their tenacity, their thoroughness, and their desire to get at the truth.
And Jim got into trouble because he was given a little bit of a seat from TWA 800 that apparently had some kind of bomb residue on it.
Well, here's what happened. Jim had his wife as a flight attendant, and they were in contact with a pilot who had actually been in the hangar at Calverton, and that pilot apparently had flown the plane from Greece, was very much concerned, of course, of, you know, colleagues died, crew members, friends of theirs died. So this pilot, found a seat cover that purported, or at least had some streaks of orange on it that they thought could have been missile fuel. They weren't sure, okay?
Right.
So they obtained a sample, and they brought a sample to a producer at CBS News named Christina Borgensen. Now, I can tell you, George, when I was a correspondent on 2020, if somebody, like, from an incident like that had brought me a sample, I would have absolutely gone out and had it tested to see what does it mean? Was it just glue, as the FBI later alleged that it was, or was it some kind of foreign substance? Could it have been an explosive residue or whatever? I definitely, as a reporter, would have pursued that. Well, Valerie Caproni called CBS, according to Christina Borgensen. She's called into the head lawyer's office on West 57th Street. at 9th Avenue. You know, our CBS News is over on 57th between 9th and 10th. She gets called into the office of this lawyer. The lawyer says, Valerie Caproni is threatening to put you in front of a grand jury tomorrow. There are two FBI agents in the lobby. They want the sample. We're giving him the sample back. And Christina's going, what are you why are you giving him the, come on. And they fired Christina Borgensen. She's gone from CBS News over this. Valerie Caproni then indicts Jim Sanders and his wife, the flight attendant. And even after the FBI sides with the NTSB and decides that this is an accident, George, and not a crime, they still prosecuted him and his wife in federal court. They spent all kinds of taxpayer money prosecuting him. What, if it's not a crime scene, then what's the crime? You know, what, tampering? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what this is. The point is, rarely in America does a federal prosecutor go to this level of trouble to shut up a journalist.
True. No, you're absolutely right.
And then, I just want to read you this one line. It's in my book, Cover Up. When I tried to get to see Greg Scarpa this summer, I wrote to Warden Hood, and just here's the line, very quick. He says, the Bureau of Prisons makes every effort to accommodate media personnel as long as the request does not negatively affect the security and operation of our institutions. It is my determination, based on my sound correctional judgment, that to grant your request at this time could pose a risk to the internal security of this institution and to the safety of staff, inmates, and members of the public. Therefore, your request is denied.
Well, you know what you should do? Just tell them you want to talk to them on the phone.
Well,
then what? That's him.
Well, I appealed the decision, and then they rejected the appeal, and now I have the right to appeal to the Bureau of Prisons in Kansas, which I'm going to do. But here's the point, George. If Greg Scarpa Jr. was a perpetrator of a hoax and a scam, if he's just a mob wise guy from Brooklyn who just made this whole thing up, what do they care who he talks to? Why don't they put him on live with you for 3 hours one night? What do they care? If he doesn't have any probative information, why are they being so protective over him?
It's the same thing trying to get a hold of Manuel Noriega. You can't get to these people.
Yeah, but Manuel Noriega was convicted of high crimes. I mean, he was the dictator of a Latin American country who, you know, legitimately was convicted.
Oh, yeah, but my point is, yeah, they don't want you to talk to these people because they're petrified what they're going to say. I've made a prediction on this show, Peter, and I'll say it again. Saddam Hussein will never be able to go before anybody. I mean, this guy's a criminal, no doubt about it.
Right.
But they don't want him talking.
Well, that's where what happened, the headline tonight in the Washington Post comes in with Zacharias Moussaoui. He's now saying, he said it once before and he reneged, now he's saying that he's going to cop a plea and therefore he'll never have to go to trial, which means none of this evidence that could be very enlightening to the American public on 9/11 is ever going to come out.
True.
There's another very interesting individual, and we can get back to Oklahoma City in a minute, but named Ali Mohammed, and you and I have talked about him in the past. Ali Mohammed was an extraordinary individual who was he was an Egyptian army officer, and when Sadat was killed in 1981 by a group of Islamic radical army officers, it was his actual unit that did the slaying. And his excuse at the time, his alibi, was he was over teaching the Green Berets at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Well, he gets out of the Egyptian army. He goes to work for a short time for the CIA. At least they admit that he worked for them at some point. He's alleged to have been kicked out of terminated by the CIA. He then works for Egypt Air as a security consultant. He then flies to America, even though he's on a U.S. watch list. He meets an American a woman who lives in Silicon Valley. They fall in love, or at least she falls in love with him. They get married 6 weeks later. He becomes a naturalized citizen. He joins the U.S. Army, becomes a supply sergeant. Where does he end up, George? Fort Bragg, North Carolina, at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School. This is the elite school that teaches not just the Green Berets, but the Army Rangers, Delta Force, you know, et cetera.
All of them, yeah.
He gets a secret security clearance, okay, even though he was on a State Department watch list. And guess what he's doing? On weekends in 1989, while he's still a U.S. soldier, active duty, he's coming up on weekends and training members of the cell that helped Ramzi Youssef blow up the World Trade Center. Four successive weekends in July, and this is at the beginning of my timeline at peterlance.com under terrorism, he's up there training these guys. They're firing AK-47s in Long Island, all kinds of automatic weapons. Of the men he's training over four weekends, Three of them went on to bomb the Trade Center. One went on to work with Blind Sheikh Rahman on the plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels around Manhattan. One of them killed Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990. And guess what? The FBI Special Operations Group, on all 4 weekends, is shooting dozens of black and white surveillance photos of these guys. They've got them all on, all of them, including Ali Muhammad. What happens to Ali Muhammad? He ends up leaving the army. He goes and moves to Silicon Valley. He then becomes Bin Laden's primary security consultant. He helps Bin Laden move from Afghanistan to Sudan in 1991. He then later, when Bin Laden is kicked out of the Sudan in 96, he moves him back to Kandahar. He trains Al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan and the Sudan. He brokers a meeting between the Hezbollah chief and Bin Laden. He is absolutely like the spy of all spies for Al-Qaeda, and he's continuing to work as an FBI informant and American citizen while all this is going on. Now, they finally pulled him over to the side of the road, metaphorically speaking, after the African embassy bombings. He knew all about, he actually participated with the co-conspirators, Wadi al-Haj. He's helped making him fake ID in Nairobi. He helps to train the Nairobi cell, etc. And finally, after the bombing, which kills 224 and injures 5,000, these two embassies on August 7th of 98, they finally arrest him, George, okay?
Took him long enough.
Took him long enough, right? 9 years later, after they know him, after he's on their radar for the first time in New York.
It's almost like they want these things to happen. It's just weird. They can't be that stupid, Peter.
Well, here's what's really remarkable. When he finally copped a plea on October 20th of 2000, okay, and you know he comes before Judge Leonard B. Sand in the Southern District, and he basically admits, it's very short. It's a 30-minute kind of court thing, and we don't know how many years, and he's never been sentenced that we know of, by the way. He's never been sentenced. He was facing at least 25 years. If you actually indicted him, he could have had multiple death penalties because he's involved with all these conspiracies, okay? And yet, to this day, no one knows where he is in the system. He's not in the prison system that we know of. And here's the main thing, George, and this gets back to Massawi and what we were talking about. When U.S. versus Bin Laden was about to happen, and they indicted Bin Laden, and they tried him in absentia with four others in New York for the African embassy bombing. And this happened in February of 01. How many months? 6 months before 9/11, right? All of the family jewels of Al-Qaeda, everything I've just told you, going back to the New York cell and Ramzi Youssef, it was all documented, and yet they don't put this guy on the stand. Now, he is the main guy that could have put Bin Laden in the room on the African embassy conspiracy. He was sent by Bin Laden to scout the embassy in 1994. He took all the pictures, diagrammed them, and he presented them to Bin Laden. And he testified that showed them to Bin Laden, and he pointed to where he wanted the suicide truck bomb to go. So this guy, under the exception to the hearsay rule that I described, would have been witness number one for the government on Bin Laden, right?
Yep.
And yet, they never called him at trial. Now, they risk losing the case against Bin Laden and not use their best witness. Why? Because defense counsel would have challenged this guy and would have ripped the lid off the 9 years of negligence by the Justice Department, the FBI, and the CIA, and the Green Berets that allowed this guy to work his way as a mole into the fabric of U.S. intelligence. And that's astonishing to me. There's like one line in the 9/11 hearing in June 16th, 2004. The last hearing that really had to do not with the day of, that was the final hearing, but this is the second to last hearing on the origin of the 9/11 plot. Patrick Fitzgerald. Now, who is he today? He's the U.S. attorney in Chicago. He's running the Ambassador Joseph C. Wilson leak investigation. He's one of the highest ranking feds there, in the Justice Department. And Patrick Fitzgerald was the assistant U.S. attorney who, in the U.S. versus Bin Laden case, he's the guy who takes the plea from Ali Muhammad. And when he's testifying in public before the 9/11 commission, he basically gives one line about Bin Laden, about Ali Muhammad. Now, when he describes Ali Muhammad, he does one line that kind of says everything I just said in the last 5 minutes about the guy. Wouldn't you think that the 10 commissioners would have been all over? You mean to tell me, Mr. Fitzgerald, that there's a guy who was working for the FBI and he was in the Green Berets and he did all the stuff for Bin Laden? Wouldn't you think that that would have produced a two-hour discussion before the 9/11?
It should
commission?
Have been huge.
Not a word. One little question from Tim Romer, who basically just whimpered out, repeated his statement, and that was it. Now, Jamie Gorelick was the Deputy Attorney General at the time of the cover-up of TWA 800. Where does she end up? One of the 9/11 commissioners. In fact, she's not just one of the 10 commissioners. She is one of the two, along with the executive director, Zelico, that got to go into the skiffs to see the secure documents.
You know? Peter, let me ask you this, because there's obviously a connection here between cover-up, foul-ups, in some of these players, and I've got to ask you this as a journalist.
Yeah.
Do you think any of this, and I'm talking about culpability now, was done on purpose? The fact that they let TWA Flight 800 happen, they let the World Trade Center bombing, the first one, happen, they let the World Trade Center plane hijacking bombings and crashes occur. First, you know, do you think there was some culpability there?
Here's what I think happened, okay? I am the expert on is the Justice Department and the New York office of the FBI. The CIA is not my area of expertise. I focused primarily on the Office of Origin for Bin Laden, all the cases, which is the New York office, the Joint Terrorist Task Force, and the Southern District and the Eastern District. That's what I know. Here's what I know. They screwed up the first time in 1992. They could have stopped Ramzi Youssef, and we got into that in my first book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, where we talked about Nancy Floyd, this great agent. She had a guy inside, an Egyptian, who infiltrated the Sheikh cell, and because of some ridiculous office politics, a new head of terrorism came in who didn't like her, made him take a polygraph again, and he left. They could have stopped the original World Trade Center bombing in 92, and they could have stopped Ramzi Youssef.
Peter, what if they didn't want to stop him?
Now, the first time, I don't believe that it rose to that level, but I believe it got there.
All right, go ahead.
Here's what I'm getting at. The first time, they were just arrogant and incompetent, okay? In other words, they saw they had these guys on the radar in 1989. Kahane gets killed. They bungle the evidence that it suggests an international conspiracy. They blow out Ahmad Salem as an informant. You know, they screw up, okay? They don't catch these guys. They don't stop Youssef. Now, later on, when they started to put these pieces together and they went, oh, my God, these are the same guys? These are the same guys? They went, uh-oh, we got to go into CYA mode here. We got to go into cover your you-know-what mode, okay? And so what they began to do, George, was create their own walls. You know, one of the great excuses for the Patriot Act was that we got to change the law because there are all these ridiculous laws preventing FBI agents from sharing information. That is just total 100% bull, okay? If these guys had just done their job, there would be no reason for the Patriot Act. I am telling you this straight out.
I agree with that.
What they did was they created their own walls. By the time 1995 happened, when Colonel Mendoza, this courageous, by the way, the Richard Clark of the Philippines, this guy is such a knowledgeable guy when it comes to Islamic fundamentalism. He unpeels the Mozart of terror, you know, the best friend, Murad, of Ramzi Youssef, and he gets these three plots. He gives them to the U.S. Embassy, and they blow it off. You know why they blow it off, George? Because they go, wait a minute, if we put Ramzi Youssef together for this plot about hijacking planes, this is years later when 9/11 happens, they go, oh my God, you know, if we make Ramzi Youssef the architect of 9/11, if we admit that he was, then everybody's going to point the finger at the New York office of the FBI and say, you could have stopped that guy in 1992. Why didn't you do it?
That's right.
So they cover that connection up. Now, here's what they do. They take all the evidence that I had, and I testified before the 9/11 Commission on the 15th of March. Governor Kane had read my book, and Hamilton had read it. Most of the commissioners had read 1,000 Years for Revenge.
Who called you? Who was the instrument to get you?
I sent the book to Governor Kane, the chairman, over Christmas. He sent me a letter in January. We want you to testify. Philip Zelico, the director, will call you. So Zelico emails me, and he said, we're going to have Dietrich Snell. And I went, Dietrich Snell? Wait a minute. Wasn't Dietrich Snell the prosecutor of the Bojinka case that covered up information relating to TWA 800? What's he doing on the 9/11 Commission? He should be a witness before the 9/11 Commission. Turns out they appointed him to be the senior counsel who was going to be in charge of the origin of the plot. Now, what's more important? Well, we'll get to this after the break.
We'll get to that after the break. Plus, there's a possible Al-Qaeda Oklahoma City bombing connection. I want you to steer us in that direction. We'll be back.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You can open up the phone lines at the top of the hour. We'll chat with Peter Luntz. Give you an opportunity to ask him some of these questions. What a connection. I'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Peter Luntz, our guest. His website, peterluntz.com. Peter, let's pick up the story where we're talking about, and then we got to get into the Al-Qaeda possible connection with Oklahoma City.
Yeah. Essentially, what's happened was Dietrich Snell, this ex-prosecutor of Ramzi Youssef, who should have fairly in front of the 9/11 Commission, been called to answer two very important questions. Why did they flush this incredible intelligence from the Philippines National Police about this plot to fly planes, hijack them, and fly them into buildings? And why did they keep the hunt for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed a secret? Now, this is an indefensible position by the Justice Department. Think about this, George. We know, they know, because they indicted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed with Youssef Murad and Wali Khan. They know that he was a member of the Manila cell. They knew that he was, that had this knowledge to build this undetectable bomb that you could smuggle on board aircraft. And yet, while Youssef was brought to ground by a very public hue and cry, you know, that he was called the most wanted man in America in Newsweek, a courageous diplomatic security agent in the State Department called Bradley Smith used the terrorist reward for justice program to put Youssef's picture on matchbook covers. His want poster was distributed all over the Middle East. And a young South African named Isaac Parker saw Youssef after Youssef tried to recruit him and dropped a dime on him. He called the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, and that's how they got him. Like the Old West, right?
Yep.
Now, here you've got Youssef's uncle, the man the FBI admits is the mastermind of 9/11 now. And by the way, you know, this is something I had in my book that's extraordinary. When Youssef fled Manila the night after the fire that he had in his bomb factory, he and Khalid Sheikh went to Islamabad. They're staying in a 20-room guest house controlled by Osama bin Laden, okay? This kid, Parker, comes in, informs the DSS and DEA agents. They storm the building and they get Youssef. They capture him, okay? Huge get for the feds. As there's an FBI agent named Bradley Garrett who happened to be in town for another case. he gets to the guest house late. Now, there are only 20 rooms in this guest house. What do most police officers do at any crime scene? They go in and canvass all the people in the building, right?
First thing they do.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is in a room on the ground floor, and he hangs around George long enough to give an interview to Time magazine in which he describes the Youssef takedown in great detail and gives his own name. And they, in Time magazine, they say a Karachi businessman named Khalid Sheikh, and he gives it yet Bradley Garrett, this FBI agent who later claimed on 60 Minutes, too, that he helped to capture Ramzi Youssef, misses Khalid Sheikh. So Khalid Sheikh is missed by the FBI. He goes on to propagate the 9/11 plot his nephew designed. Now, why do they keep his name a secret? Why? Because of blunders like this, and because they don't want to connect Ramzi Youssef to this 9/11, to this plot. Now, they don't know in 1996 that it's going to be 9/11, but they know this Khalid Sheikh is out there. Now, here's the thing. Okay?
And we've got him now, right?
We got him March of 2003, and this is important that you say that, because I'm going to get to how he relates to the 9/11 Commission and the origin of the plot. Now, if you go back and look at the Kennedy assassination, what's the most important question? Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone?
Right.
What's the most important question that the 9/11 Commission was charged with answering? The origin of the plot. How did it happen? When did it happen? Because if we can't determine when the plot was conceived, we can't tell whether any of our agencies were culpable in failing to detect it,
true.
Right?
Or they knew it and didn't want to say anything for other... And that's
exactly.
Another theory.
You agree that the origin of the plot is a crucial point,
yes.
Right? Okay.
Yes.
They, instead of having Dietrich Snell... Oh, by the way, let me just finish the one point about Khalid Sheikh. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's name does not surface publicly until January 1998. Youssef is finally convicted in Bojinka. He's convicted in the Trade Center plot, and he's sentenced by Judge Duffy. The famous sentencing happened in January of 98, in which Youssef said, "I'm a terrorist and I'm proud of it." Judge Duffy called him an apostle of evil. And Youssef is sentenced. The New York Times story on that sentencing, the next day, on the inside jump page of the story, not the headline, not a subheadline, there's a little obscure reference on the inside saying the Justice Department today unsealed an indictment of one Khaled Sheikh Mohammed, believed to be a relative of Ramzi Youssef. There's like a peripheral little kind of mention in the New York Times. At this point, what do we know now? That we know now, by 1978, he's in Hamburg with Atta and the boys, and he's well on his way to perfecting the plot that his nephew conceived of in 1994, 4 years earlier. Why was this guy not the subject of a public hue and cry? That's what I wanted to know when I finished my first book. So I'm called before the 9/11 Commission. I thought, well, I'm going to go in and I'm going to testify. And I made it a quid pro quo, if they wanted me, that everything would go on the record. And Governor Keene agreed. So I go in. And when I get to 26 Federal Plaza in New York with the FBI office, where they also had an office, I go into a conference room, and who's in there? Dietrich Snell. And there's an FBI agent named Marco Cordero who's assigned to the staff. There's no stenographer in the room. There's no recording equipment in the room. Dietrich sits across from me with a little reporter's notebook, and he's taking notes. And I'm going, wait a minute, I thought I was testifying before the 9/11. You are. I said, well, where's the record? Well, fortunately, I knew, because I had a source inside the commission, that this was going to happen. I didn't know it was going to be Snell. I thought they'd have at least other people there.
Sure.
And basically,
you thought the whole committee would be there.
Yeah, so I prepared my testimony ahead of time, and it's in the back of cover-up. But every single time, I asked Dietrich Snell as many questions as he asked me.
Oh, my.
And every time I'd ask him a question, he'd go, classified. I can't discuss it. I can't discuss it.
Oh, my.
And here's one of the great ironies of all time. So Dietrich Snell is the author of the staff statement on the origin of the plot. And now Peter Lance, and not just Peter Lance, but, you know, Colonel Mendoza, Maria Ressa, the bureau chief for CNN in Manila, other journalists have supported my reporting and have corroborated it and said that the Philippines National Police discovered this plot in 1995, okay? In fact, Colonel Mendoza, the night of 9/11, somebody said, text message him to turn on CNN. He did. He saw the South Tower fall, and the first words were, they have done it! They have done it!
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he knew that those were the guys, and he was sure the FBI would have prevented this. Okay, well now, here I am, you know, I'm testifying, I put this stuff in, on the 9/11 report comes out. And I knew that it was going to be a whitewash because I had been looking at the staff statements and judging them against the research I'd done. And sure enough, my little testimony is reduced to kind of an end note. And they reached the conclusion that the plot didn't begin in 1994 with Ramzi Youssef. That began in 1996. That Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on his own came up with this plot. That he wasn't even a member of Al-Qaeda, George, until 1996. And that he happened to bring it to bin Laden and kind of pitched it to him in 1996. That's the official conclusion of the last official body to investigate the biggest mass murder in American history. They pushed the origin of the plot 2 years forward to remove Ramzi Youssef from it.
All right, let's see if there's a tie-in here now with Oklahoma City.
Okay. The circumstantial case, and it is circumstantial, but when you look at all the dots, it's quite extraordinary. Terry Nichols was essentially a ne'er-do-well. He literally applied for a job as a farmhand when the year before 9/11 declared bankruptcy. He was just broke. He'd made four separate trips to the Philippines from 1992 to 94. He's married to a Filipina named Marife Torres, whose father was a police officer in the southern Philippines town of Cebu City. Now, Cebu City is a hotbed of radical Islamic activity in the southern Philippines. The guest house that they stayed in was a guest house that was frequented by members of the Abu Sayyaf, which is one of the Al-Qaeda terror groups. There are two Al-Qaeda-related terror groups in the Philippines. One is called the Abu Sayyaf. Ramzi Youssef, in the early 90s, taught Abu Sayyaf members how to build bombs. Ramzi Youssef now, in 1994, as I said, is in Manila with Khalid Sheikh, Wali Khan, and Murad, and they're plotting these three plots to kill the Pope, Bojinka, and what we now know to be the 9/11 plot. Terry Nichols is in the Philippines at the same time. In fact, Terry Nichols and Ramzi Youssef are in Cebu City at the very same day. We can put them in the same town.
How ironic, Peter.
Also, Edwin Angeles, who is one of the founders of the Abu Sayyaf, who was later murdered, he turned state's evidence, and I have an affidavit with his thumbprint on it, in which he said that he was in a room with Ramzi Youssef, Abdul Hakim Murad, and Terry Nichols, who they call the farmer, in Davao City in the southern Philippines as early as 1991. There were a number of other extraordinary, like, alleged coincidences, but here's one of the most important things. And Rita Cosby, who I have a lot of faith in, did a documentary, was on Sunday night on Fox News, but she happened to miss this one point, and I think this is the central point. When Michael Fortier, if you remember, was the chief witness for the government in the Oklahoma City bombing,
right.
He was a close friend of McVeigh's. And in the fall of 1994, McVeigh was experimenting with ammonium nitrate fuel oil as an explosive device. He attempted to blow up a metal milk jug in a sort of a desert area.
On some farm, right?
Yeah, and in a rural area,
yeah.
And it fizzled. It was like my son, who's 18, could have done a better job with his chemistry set, okay? And so it fizzled. Now, that's October, okay, by the account of the chief government witness. In April, they build a device that is so complicated and with such power that it literally takes down the federal building, okay? The only difference that we know of that happened was that Terry Nichols is in the Philippines with Ramzi Youssef during that period. The Darryl Bridges phone card, which they used, when Terry Nichols fled the Philippines, which about a week after Youssef was, the bomb factory was blown.
What do you mean by fled?
Well, he left the Philippines about a week after Ramzi Youssef bomb factory was blown, and he comes back to the U.S., and begins participating in earnest in the construction of some kind of a device. And there were multiple phone calls to the guest house where Marife Nichols was. I'm talking about in the 24-hour period, like 60 calls to this guest, like as if someone was saying, where does the red wire go? Where does the blue wire go? Et cetera, okay? Ramzi wasn't there, but others that had knowledge of high explosives were and could have been in the area, and they could have been accessing that kind of information. Now, on the day of the bombing, the 19th of April, okay, 10 years ago today, the Abdul Hakim Murad, the lifelong friend of Youssef, who I told you had confessed to Colonel Mendoza about the three plots, he's now at the MCC, the federal jail in Lower Manhattan, the same jail where Youssef was with Scarpa. And when he hears a radio report, spontaneously, George, he begins saying, we did that, we did that. And the jailer, the guard comes over, what are you talking about? That was us, that was us. And the guy says, he asks him for a piece of paper, and he writes down Liberation Army. Now, Youssef called his cell the 5th Battalion of the Liberation Army, and the FBI now sends two FBI agents over to interview Murad, and they write up an FBI 302 memo, which I have in my book, 1,000 Years for Revenge. It's in the book, and the memo was later admitted in the Bojinka case as evidence by the government that Murad was involved in a conspiracy as late as April 19th of 95. Now, if that was just a frivolous thing where he was just mouthing off and taking credit for something he wasn't involved in, why would the FBI come over there? Why would they memorialize it in a 302 memo? And why would they enter it into evidence in 1996, a year later, as evidence that he was involved in a conspiracy? The point is, I talked to Stephen Jones, the original lawyer for McVeigh. He told me that he had Tim with his investigators one day, and they say, Tim, draw the device, okay? It's very important. You taking credit for this, Tim? You know, he ended up going to his grave claiming that he was the genius behind this thing. And he drew a series of circles and lines that a 12-year-old could have drawn.
Right.
And he said, no, Tim, draw the bomb. And Tim says, well, I don't want to draw the bomb. Well, no, come on, Tim. You know how to, you built it, right? Oh, yeah, I built it. How'd you learn how to build it, Tim? Well, I got a book out of the Kingman, Arizona Library. Well, what's the name of it? I don't remember. Well, they send everybody up to the Kingman, Arizona Library. There's no book in there. Okay, of course. Tim McVeigh had no knowledge of explosives, didn't have any idea how to build this bomb. The only possible alternate explanation to the Ramzi Youssef theory is the Elohim City theory, where there was this individual called Strassmeier, a German, who could have, it's possible, bomb-making experience. Did he have the bomb-making experience of Ramzi Youssef? That was unparalleled. And by the way, it was just like Youssef's ego to have the bomb delivered in a Yellow Rider truck, which is exactly the device, how the payload for the original world. That's just kind of, that's like a little Ramzi Youssef.
That's his MO, right?
That's a little wink. Yeah, that's Ramzi's ego. You know what I'm saying? So I think what happened was that they had these patsies, Nichols and McVeigh, fronted for this conspiracy.
Do you think they paid them? Do you think any money changed hands?
Well, I do know this, that the government's main explanation for how McVeigh and Nichols financed this, and remember, just before Nichols went to the Philippines, he went to Lena Padilla, his former wife, and he gave her a note and he said, to be opened on my death, right? And he was really worried that something could happen to him when he went to the Philippines. And she found, she opened it prematurely and found like gold, some bars, some semi-precious stones, and X amount of thousands of dollars in cash that he had squirreled away in the kitchen of, I guess, her house. And so where did he get this penniless guy get this stuff? Well, the government explained it as saying that he had participated in a series of robberies with McVeigh, one of whom was in the home of this guy, Roger Moore, which I alluded to earlier. Roger Moore is the one that Terry Nichols, through Greg Scarpa, now is saying supplied these explosives that they found that were buried in the crawl space that they just found last month. Roger Moore, Terry believes, fingerprints are on those boxes. Or he says they were sent from Royal Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is where he was from, by UPS. He UPS these explosives, according to Scarpa Jr., quoting Nichols. And Nichols, what happened at trial was Moore's girlfriend testified and claimed that he'd been robbed on a certain date, and they believed that Terry Nichols, the guy in the ski mask, well, Terry Nichols wore glasses. The guy didn't have glasses on the ski mask. Terry couldn't see past the barn door. No way is he going to rob this guy who's a gun dealer. And they later determined that two of the guns that Moore said had been robbed were actually purchased by Nichols at a gun show a couple of years earlier. So Moore's credibility was in question, and there was no explanation for the financing, where these guys got this money to build this huge device.
I got to tell you, what about the third person, the person that on the day of the event?
John Doe number two?
John Doe number two, yep.
That's another interesting story. And watching, the great thing about watching Rita Cosby's piece that was on Fox on Sunday night is that she did lay out the official FBI story, and they had two of the agents that were investigating, and they claimed that they found John Doe number two. Essentially what happened was, you know, McVeigh was using the name Robert Kling. McVeigh had gone to a tire store and gone in to ask directions, and that there was a witness, a very good witness, who said he saw this swarthy-looking Middle Eastern guy in the truck, and gave a sketch, and the sketch was this, it's in my book, it's on, I think it might even be on my website, peterlance.com. Yeah, if you go to peterlance.com and hit terrorism, and you look at the timeline, you'll see the sketch of how McVeigh looks exactly like Robert Kling, and how Nichols looks nothing like John Doe number two. And this John Doe number two, and remember, the indictment was for others unknown, and they did this massive manhunt for John Doe number two, and then they just decided at one point, you know what, there's no John Doe number two, the guy was mistaken. They just decided that the guy was mistaken.
Wasn't there some video, Peter, of the truck and people getting out, McVeigh, pictures of them, and we've never seen it?
Well, there are witnesses, many witnesses that said they saw MEs or in bureau speak Middle Eastern men getting out of the truck, one getting with McVeigh and several in the area. But this video, which Rita made a very good point of, is still being withheld by the government. Why? 10 years later, there were, like, Mike Johnson, who's a courageous lawyer in Oklahoma City who has really fought for full disclosure on this. Mike Johnson testified or said in the Cosby documentary that there are, he said he believed, up to 25 separate cameras. But certainly there was a camera from this hotel or apartment building across the street, of which they only showed a still of the wider truck. Why isn't that video, why hasn't it been produced?
It's the same with 9/11, where there's apparently video of the plane that people say never hit the Pentagon. There's supposed to be video of something, and that won't be released either. I mean, and why? You know, you would think they would say, all right, here it is, folks. Here's the plane.
Yeah.
But they're not doing that.
Well, again, in Oklahoma City, let's just look at different scenarios. If, in fact, there's a Ramzi Youssef connection to Oklahoma City, and by the way, Stephen Jones told me that was his defense. His defense was, for Tim McVeigh, was that Ramzi Youssef taught him how to build a bomb. Judge Mache refused to allow it to go in, so he couldn't have that defense.
Okay, how come they're not jumping up and down publicly saying, we did this? And I'm talking about Al-Qaeda, those kinds of people.
Well, in the case of the TWA 800 crash, remember, Youssef wanted a mistrial, so the last thing he's going to do is admit that his people did it.
I agree with that.
Although, what's really interesting, by the way, George, is that there's a case of a year later where they captured these Islamic terrorists called the subway bombers in Brooklyn, and they hit their house, and they were related to Iranian Hezbollah, which has great ties, believe it or not, with Al-Qaeda, even though they're Shiites versus Sunnis. And they found a letter in this apartment in Brooklyn saying our people, quote, are responsible for the TWA-800, and you should release Ramzi Youssef from jail. But that's why they didn't take credit for TWA. With respect to Oklahoma City, it was a brilliant strategic move. It was like a patsy. They were patsies. They were able to inflict great damage on the United States and let these two homegrown, you know, weasels take credit for it.
Exactly. Let's find out why Terry Nichols isn't saying anything when we come back, and phone calls with our guest, Peter Lentz.